200 or 250 years ago in the United States, or what previous the United States, I suspect once again, if I said, all right, I'm going to talk about natural law this morning, we might have everybody in the village here, you know, eagerly interested in talking about it, because it was extremely important in Calvinism. You can't make any defensible sense out of Thomas Jefferson or out of Thoreau unless you presuppose the Calvinistic doctrine of natural law. Because without natural law, you cannot have confidence in the ordinary man, to the extent at least that both Jefferson and Thoreau were willing to have confidence. So consequently, what I want to do is to indicate what the confessions say about it, to indicate from Scripture why they said what they did. Both the confessions and Scripture constitute a problem. So, I'll try to state the problem succinctly and then indicate a variety of kinds of options, most of which are historical, whereby one can resolve the problem, and hopefully it'll give us about 10 or 15 minutes where we can chat with one another about it, because none of these positions do really resolve the problem, but realizing all the genius that's present at Holden Village, maybe we can solve the Lutheran Church's historical problem of natural law right here on the spot and have it recorded for posterity over here. Okay? All right. There are several places. I must apologize right now because I had a lovely passage from the Apology, the Augsburg Confession, and I don't find it right now. But at any rate, in the Apology of the Augsburg Confession, in Article 4 on Justification, Scripture is distributed into the two topics, the law and the promises. And in talking about the law, he says, human reason naturally understands the law. It has the same judgment divinely written in the mind. And it says, the natural law agrees with the law of Moses or the Ten Commandments, and by the law, natural man seeks the remission of sin and justification. Now, in brief, this is the Lutheran confessional doctrine of natural law. That common to all men is a moral law written in the mind of every man. It coincides with the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. Now, in another of the confessional documents in the Formula of Concord, in the Thorough Declaration, the section on the third use of God's law, the statement is made that in natural man the law is obscured so that he does not have it clearly. But he still got it, and on the basis of it, he is outwardly moral, and also on the basis of it, he is justifiably condemnable by God. Now, the source of those particular doctrines, which go back very early in the church, are from the book of Romans. Two different passages, the second one of which is a bit more precise than the first one. Romans 1:18-21, for we see divine retribution revealed from heaven and falling upon all the godless wickedness of men. In their wickedness they are stifling the truth, for all that may be known of God by men lies plain before their eyes. Indeed, God himself has disclosed it to them. His invisible attributes, that is to say, his everlasting power and deity, have been visible ever since the world began. To the eye of reason, in the things he has made, there is therefore no possible defense for their conduct. Knowing God, they have refused to honor him as God or to render him thanks. And that takes care of the first table of the law. 2:14 and following. When Gentiles who do not possess the law, the Old Testament law, carry out its precepts by the light of nature, then although they have no law, they are their own law, for they display the effect of the law inscribed on their hearts. Their conscience is called as witness, and their own thoughts argue the case on either side against them or even for them, on the day when God judges the secrets of human hearts through Christ Jesus. All right, now there's the Bible background for the statements in the confessions, and I suspect it's apparent that there are a few problems here. Now, when one gets around in philosophy to something like a natural law doctrine here, I suspect the first question which one asks is, all right, now, if there is such a thing as this, we ought to be able to exhibit it psychologically. We ought to be able to point to something or other about people which will, in psychological terms, exhibit it and explain it as a phenomenon. Because if the will of God is written in the mind of man or in the heart of man, whatever either of those two terms mean, it is an appropriate subject matter for philosophy, for philosophical ethics. It is an appropriate subject matter for psychology. And we ought to be able to handle it in philosophic terms and psychological terms. So consequently, the task is then to come up with it. Now, in philosophy, about the earliest statement of a kind of natural law doctrine is in Cicero, and generally within the Stoic tradition. In Cicero's Cicero's De Republica, Cicero says that the world, the universe, is completely rational. It moves according to rational rules. Man is by nature a rational creature, as both Plato and Aristotle agreed. And most of the ancient Greeks, except the wag who, or the guy who thought that man could be defined as a featherless biped until his friend came along and held up a plucked chicken and said, "Behold man." But you don't find a natural law doctrine in either Plato or Aristotle. But Cicero says, now look, the universe is completely rational. It moves according to rational rules in perfect regularity and order. The only thing which is irrational is man when he's not following his reason. So consequently, man must live rationally. He must curb his passions. He must live the Stoic life. And when he follows his reason, he will discover the laws for living rightly. So all you've got to do is follow your brains. He then proceeded to state commonly accepted Roman principles of good behavior and bad behavior, but offered no rational defense for them. So anyway, this is Cicero, and all of the medievals go back to Cicero as the original source for natural law. And Cicero's is thought to be, you know, this is Cicero's primary contribution to the Christian tradition. Okay, we take you up to Thomas Aquinas, who represents a kind of a distillation of one tradition of Roman Catholic thought, or of the Church's thought in the Aristotelian tradition. And what Thomas Aquinas says is there are four kinds of law. There is eternal law, there is natural law, there is divine law, and there is positive law. Eternal law, the laws of the universe. I suppose up until about the 20th century, people would have said eternal laws are what Newton discovered and wrote down for us. These are the principles according to which the universe operates, the rules which God put into his universe so that it would move in an orderly fashion. And this is eternal law. Natural law is derived from eternal law, and it is the law which describes the appropriate goodness at which each kind of nature should aim. And since there is such a thing as the good man, the natural law for man are those kinds of laws which enable him to be a good man. Divine law, which is pretty well reducible to the Ten Commandments and Christ's two love principles, love God, love your neighbor. These are a revelation of natural law and identical with it. And the reason why God revealed it is because man had sort of lost it. It had gotten obscured. Man had gone off in another kind of direction, and so God had to reveal it to him. But it's identical with natural law for man. And finally, positive law is things like 10 miles per hour outside this building with a moving vehicle, you know, things like that, or any kind of laws which are passed by any kind of legislature, which vary from one place to another and don't hold across the board. All right. Now, with respect to natural law, Thomas Aquinas says that moral precepts, you know, the ultimate natural law, moral precepts, are the sorts of things that the natural reason of every man judges immediately. You see it immediately. It doesn't have to follow from a deductive proof. It's immediately apparent. Any rational man can see this is right. For instance, honor thy father and mother, and thou shalt not kill, and thou shalt not steal. Precepts of this kind belong in an unqualified way to the law of nature, and you can see immediately that they're right. These are beyond any kind of argument. They're almost intuitive. On the other hand, there are other kinds of moral rules that belong to the law of nature also, but which require instruction. As for the wiser people have to teach the ignorant people. As for instance, rise up before the hoary head and honor the person of the aged man. In other words, respect for the elderly. This is something that people don't just know naturally. And once again, there are some things where the human mind needs to be instructed divinely. I take that to mean where we need revelation. Thou shalt not make to thyself a graven thing or the likeness of anything. Thou shalt not take the name of thy God in vain. First and second commandments. In brief, this is Aquinas' position, and it remains the official position of the Roman Catholic Church today. Now, in contrast to this, let me briefly present Philip Melanchthon's position. And I'm going to present it briefly for two reasons. One is for reasons of time, and secondly, it's been almost 18 years since I looked at it, and I thought sure that we had a copy of Melanchthon's 1521 Loci here, and we don't. So I have to kind of talk from an 18-year-old memory about this. Melanchthon, in Aquinas, we have the expression in Latin, lex naturalis, natural law. In Melanchthon, we have lex naturae, the law of nature. And what Melanchthon is talking about is my nature has a certain kind of law according to which it goes well. And so, whereas Aquinas would say, all right, now what you've got to do is look at the world and how things are laid out and look at this law like thou shalt not kill, and you can tell immediately that that's the way it's got to be. As you look at social context and the ends at which things aim, and then you can see, you know, that this is, you know, it's absolutely essential for human society. On the other hand, Melanchthon says we must study the human psychology. We must look at the laws that are appropriate for man's human nature and how man best functions. And then we see the law of his nature. Now, both Aquinas and Melanchthon appeal to reason. We can see this in the reason of man, by the reason of man. And they both talk in terms of function, but the one talks in terms of the outer world, the other one tends to talk in terms of the inner world. And they come up with the same things, you know, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, and so on. Now, let me jump a few centuries and get out of the theologians into the philosophers and present a couple of philosophic positions which were not presented as natural law positions, but which very well could be. And the first one is David Hume. David Hume, in his ethical treatises, particularly in his inquiry concerning the origin of human morals, says the origin of morality is a common attribute of human nature. It also happens to be the source of aesthetics and of aesthetical agreement. Nature has so fashioned man that there is a natural relationship between a behavior and man's response to it. In other words, suppose that at the end of this session we come walking out of this building and we would see a couple of boys out here, a big one and a small one, and the big one was beating the daylights out of the small one. Would we regather in here to consider among ourselves as to whether that was a good act or a bad act? Would we say, in the long run, it is not good for human society for forms of behavior of that sort to be indulged in? Or would we say, the boy that is getting beaten up is less likely to achieve the good of which he is capable if this form of behavior persists? You know, would we do this kind of thing, or would we immediately know it was wrong? And Hume says we would know it was wrong. There is a natural something or other built into our guts where we automatically approve of or disapprove of behaviors. And this is common to man. And so Hume says, therefore, the ultimate source of morality is the approbation or blame of an uninvolved spectator. Not of a guy involved in the situation, but a guy who has no axe to grind, who sees what's going on. His reaction to it is the criterion of goodness or evil, and this is the source from which we get ultimately all of our human morality. Now, obviously, there are all kinds of ways that this can get screwed up, because if we've got an axe to grind here, for instance, if the big kid is my son, it may not appear nearly as immoral as if the little kid is my son. See? In other words, we have ways of screwing it up because we're involved. Our biases, our prejudices, all sorts of things of this sort have ways of screwing up this pure reaction. And we may be feeling kind of sick and tired of moralizing about everything, and something goes on in there, and I'm tired and I don't want to get involved, and so I just head up to my lodge and go to bed. Or I got a headache like Herb has. How's the headache, Herb? Well, great. Great. And already we've had a good day. Very good. I met Herb this morning and he did not know over which of his two heads to put his sweater. Okay. So there are all kinds of ways it can get screwed up. It can also get perverted, as can anything else in human psychology. And so we can pervert it. But here is this natural emotive response to things, and you can see, you can work out a beautiful natural law doctrine on the basis of this kind of an approach, and it's a totally affective kind of approach, and actually it's the first one in history. Let me shift now to a guy who thought that Hume was great, except he didn't go far enough, and didn't follow Hume here, and that's Immanuel Kant. Immanuel Kant sets forth a natural law doctrine, which he doesn't call natural law, but very well could be called natural law. Many people since him have speculated about whether it is natural law or not. But Immanuel Kant set forth a beautiful, rational type of ethics, ethical procedure. And it operates this way. He set forth his doctrine as a categorical imperative. So act that thy maxim may serve as a rule for behavior for all mankind. He thought that this was a statement of the golden rule and that it was the essence of Christian ethics as taught in the New Testament. And that Jesus would, if he had been living in his day, would have attended the University of Königsberg and been a Kantian. And for two centuries thereafter, I think many theologians agreed. Well, at any rate, let me explain a bit about the categorical imperative. Because this is an ethical principle which only a mathematician or logician could have come up with. Kant was thinking in this kind of way. Of everything which there is in the world, everything has its law and its maxims except man. Newton has just discovered the laws and maxims for the outer world. Nobody has come up with the maxims for the inner world, although my friend David Hume over in England has been trying very, very hard to come up with that in his treatise on human nature, which was intended to be the physics of the inner world, even as Newton's Principia was the physics for the outer world. So Kant said, "In God has created man different from everything else. Everything else has its maxim and its principles, and it goes according to them, and it has no alternative but to. Man, according to his physical nature, as a physical object, also functions this way. But man, with respect to his inner world, is completely free. And the essence of freedom is that, and what freedom ultimately is definable as, is the ability to write your own laws for yourself and to obey them. This is the essence of freedom, to live according to laws self-enacted. Now, for a law to have validity, it must hold for anybody under those kind of circumstances. So consequently, it's not everybody doing his own thing, but man using his reason to determine what would be the behavior that would be right for him. Now, how do you determine what makes your behavior right? Ultimately, in Kant, according to the examples which he gives, ultimately in Kant, there are two principles which he thinks reduces to one principle. The one is the principle of self-contradiction, which is an ultimate logical, mathematical principle. The second one is the principle of consistency, which he felt, you know, the larger group reduced to the principle of self-contradiction also. It is irrational for a man to behave in such a way that the results of his behavior contradict what he has in mind when he does what he does. On this basis, suicide is indefensible. Suicide is a self-contradictory act. Therefore, man cannot commit suicide, because man as an actor acts in such a way as to prohibit him from being an actor. And that's self-contradictory behavior. Therefore, thou shalt not kill thyself, you know, is demonstrably true for man. Thou shalt not kill. If you act on this, on the maxim, thou shalt kill, what you are doing is legislating for all man the destruction of mankind. Because you are saying everyone can and ought to kill his fellow man. And what will happen if we act on that maxim? There won't be any more human beings, or there'll be one pretty bloodied one. And everybody else will be dead. This is irrational. This is inconsistent with your reason for acting, which is to live. So consequently, killing is irrational. It is contradictory to reason. And he then proceeded to get into the subject of lying and argued that thou shalt not lie, sort of the eighth commandment, you know, that this is indefensible because it is impossible for a community to exist where everyone lies. Since that time, a number of people have written little monographs arguing that if there were a community where everybody lied and everybody knew that everybody was lying, it would work out perfectly well. As a matter of fact, there's reason to believe that that's the kind of community we've got. Only we don't know it. The trouble is where you got some people that are liars and some people that aren't, and some people sometimes lie and sometimes don't lie, and you don't know who's who. That's when you got trouble. But if everybody lied consistently, if we created a society that was totally false, this society would be just as viable as a society that was totally true. Because it would be completely consistent, and everything everybody did would be perfectly predictable, and all you would have to do would be to take the contradiction of what anybody said, and you have the truth. You know, and what greater security could you have than that? So, consequently, a lot of people have argued that Kant's argument about falsehood and his argument about honesty are not defensible purely on the doctrine of, or on the principle of self-contradiction. Well, what I want to point out here is that Kantian ethics ultimately purports to be deductive, to follow from the laws of logic, particularly the principle of contradiction. A polar opposite to the Humean position, which ultimately operates on the basis of a totally affective response to human behavior, which one observes. All right, now, another kind of position which I want to toss in here before we get into talking about the topic, well, let me throw a couple more in, is the kind of traditional Calvinist position, particularly the early New England Calvinist position, which argued that, yes, there is such a thing as natural law. It is exhibited in the conscience of man. God has not left man without resource. And the resource which God has given to man, apart from his word which reveals him to man, is in man's conscience. Every man has a conscience, and the content of every man's conscience is identical. And man, if man will only follow his conscience, he will lead a life which is moral, pleasing to God. And the New England people began to think they discovered by experience, also guaranteed to give you success in this world, financially and otherwise. And this kind of natural law is the foundation stone for general Protestantism up until about World War II. The general Protestant American religious outlook and attitude, and a kind of belief that we didn't have to examine our values and we didn't have to come up with any values because they were just sort of given. in our conscience. And all we had to do was consult our conscience and follow our conscience. And we would know what was right, what was good, and what was pleasing to God. Finally, a kind of natural law, the way that John Dewey probably would have written it if John Dewey had been a natural law ethicist, which he wasn't. What is right for me to do is to be found in the situation which surrounds me, and but I've got to go beyond the situation which surrounds me. I've got to go beyond my environment and who I am. But I have to consider my ends, my goals, what I would like to achieve, the situation being the way it is. And then I must act, having examined a number of alternative ways that would look like they might achieve what I want. And in the final analysis, then, that will be right which is practical. That will be right which achieves the ends which I happen to want at that time and which get resolved. In other words, success is the criterion of correctness of behavior. But within the situation, there is a kind of law operating, which I can't get at and which I can't codify or anything else of that sort. But it will just sort of work out. And I will know when I'm wrong, because it won't work. The only way I will know that I'm right is that it did work, for the problem ceased to be a problem. And then I will know that it was right. To some extent, these kinds of experiences may be of help to me in the future if I encounter a kind of similar sort of situation, but more likely they won't be. And so every kind of situation in which I find myself where I've got problems will have a great deal of familiarity about it, but will also have some novelty in it. It will be a totally new kind of situation, which I'll have to deal with in novel kinds of ways. But if I use my brains and my good old Yankee common sense, I'll solve it. And so we get here a kind of a common sense natural law, as opposed to a kind of mathematical, logical natural law which you find in Kant, wherein a priori you can determine what is right. Well, apart from this and simply following your heart because your heart is good if your heart is right, these are pretty many of the kind of directions that one can go in trying to figure out what Paul means and what the Book of Concord is trying to get at when Paul talks about a law for the Gentiles which they have and by which they go, and where the Book of Concord talks about there being a natural law according to which all men act and which keeps them from being any more vicious than they are. So this gives you some grist for the mill of discussion, and you now have an opportunity to settle the question of Lutheran natural law once and for all, and then Jim can take it back to his seminary, you know, and be the first to enlighten the Lutheran multitude, you know, and I'll write to a couple of my friends at Concordia Seminary, the Missouri Synod's convention, its latest... Its convention, its latest attempt at self-assassination begins today. And maybe we could even wire them the word. And they would then know. Right. P-R-E-Y. Okay. Where are we going to find, well, let me toss a little problem out to you. I can work with something like, you know, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal. You get a few problems with thou shalt not steal in a kind of country where there's no private property. I guess you can still steal a guy's wife if you do away with marriage and the kids are raised by the state. You know, there are fewer and fewer things you have problems with. Jim was talking this morning about how the gaps got smaller and smaller. The gaps are getting smaller and smaller for thou shalt not steal as a viable ultimate principle of behavior. To such an extent, you know, that there have been a variety of people that have argued that there has to be such a thing as private property, otherwise there's nothing for the seventh commandment to be against, and the seventh commandment's got to be against something, therefore there has to be private property.
Bill,
yeah.
I heard a very interesting interpretation of the law.
Uh-huh.
Specifically as it relates itself to the Ten Commandments.
All right.
The interpretation is that the Ten Commandments, as they were understood by the people who first got them,
yeah,
meant, thou shalt not kill another Jew.
Yeah, right.
Thou shalt not steal,
yeah,
from another Jew. Thou shalt not commit adultery,
yeah,
against another Jew.
But give it to the Philistines?
Huh?
But really give
but
it to
the Philistines?
Philistines, yeah.
To the Midianites,
right.
To whoever else is,
yeah,
wrong.
All right, let me build a little bit on that, Will, because I've gotten into some arguments with some of our Old Testament people, and they haven't been too successful in arguing against me. But they suggest that the Ten Commandments, as given to the Jewish people, were, and in agreement with what you've said, that these were not given to them as moral principles, but they were given to them as social formative principles in order to create a kind of society. And these were to be social regulative principles. You don't kill one another, because if you do, you aren't going to survive out in the desert. We aren't going to have any society. And so on. And so all of these function to create what the New Testament called a peculiar people. And they were social ethical principles to produce a kind of a society, and they had a very close relationship to what we call a ceremonial principle. Do you agree?
I'm inclined to agree.
Which then raises the question, you know, what do the Ten Commandments mean today? Now, the one that I've got the most trouble with as a natural law is the sixth. See? And I've never seen anybody come up with a good argument, you know, on the base as a natural principle. I'm reminded of Kant didn't come up with too how to deal there. And what he finally did was, he said, he was talking about inclination and people arguing that they can't overcome their natural inclinations to be good. And he said, take the man who says, I want to be a good man, but I just cannot keep myself from going to the house of prostitution. And Kant said, well, we can help that man very easily. All that we have to do is erect outside that house of prostitution a gibbet with the hangman's noose and pass a law. Every male that emerges from this building will be immediately hanged. And it will be amazing how fast sins against the sixth commandment will disappear. Well, you know, if you got to put the threat of death over people, where's natural law here? Say, where is there any kind of inner feelings of restraint, compulsion, guilt, and so on? And when one examines the natural behavior of the few primitives we've got left in the world, this seems to be one that they're rather careless about and not particularly concerned about. And so this one has particularly bothered me. I could even kind of make out a case for the ninth and tenth commandments. We got all kinds of problems with the third one, don't we? Yeah, we do all kinds of wiggling with that word Sabbath, the holy day, and so on, in order to make this a viable rule. I sometimes wonder whether, if there were no clergymen in the world, the third commandment would survive. Because, see, if there were no third commandment, at whom would you preach? See? What would you do on Sunday morning? You'd have to go out and fish and golf with the other guys from the parish. So I sometimes wonder, and I'm very busy being the devil's advocate right now, what would happen if the clergy didn't defend the third commandment? I recall the time that you guys in the ALC may have had a similar experience. I recall when we were involved with the new translation of Luther's Small Catechism, and most of the argument was about the wording of the third commandment. That's the one that the clergy were all upset about. And very concerned that it should be worded just right so that people knew that on Sunday morning they were to be in church. Jim?
There's a book edited by Paul Ramsey and Gene Almstead on Norman Pentecost in Christian Ethics, and there are, I forget, 3-4 articles on natural law written by various people. Mm-hmm. Bernard Herring, Roman Catholic theologian, who writes in that section. And it seems to me there's a consistent pattern among all the writers there that they are trying, I think, rather desperately to hang on to the notion of natural law, but they are injecting elements into the notion of natural law, such as dynamic elements. Herring says there's no possibility of talking about natural law without talking about historical realities. Mm. What's natural law today is different from what was natural law before.
Mm, which is a self-contradictory remark.
Right. So the whole relativism thing is getting injected. The other element that gets injected is the empirical element, that if there is a natural law, it cannot be determined simply rationally, but it must be built up from data. Mm-hmm. And I think it's David Little in that piece that tries to put Calvin together with some Swedish anthropologist and say that, as a matter of fact, if you do go out and do your anthropology carefully, you find out that you come up at the same place that Calvin came up. Mm-hmm. And, well, that may or may not be true depending on what anthropologist you talk to, but it's at least significant that it's not enough for Little to simply say this is it. He's got to support it empirically. So both the element of empiricism and the element of relativism are very much there. Jacques Ellul, also in the Foundation of Law, Roman Catholic French jurist, makes the point, if I recall what he says in that book, that natural law theory has always been built up at times in history when, in fact, it was not practiced in the court. when natural law theory was being practiced in the court, nobody even thought to write anything about it.
Yeah.
But it was when the thing disintegrated that people kind of frantically scrambled around to try to put together natural law theory.
I know, this is one reason why I think we may be in for a lot of debate in Lutheranism about natural law.
I guess I think so too, and I think that it is, if we are going to continue to use that term, it seems to me we're going to find ourselves in a situation where the Catholics also are, so we're going to have to radically revise that notion to include in it elements of relativism, historicism, dynamism, empiricism.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that's a very frightening kind of thing, because a nice tight world has collapsed again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I suspect, a little more speculation, I suspect that probably a kind of a starting point will be when a person becomes motivated by God, Spirit of God animates him. And, you know, can animate him in a great variety of directions depending on what his situation is. And this is not purely motive power, but it has a certain directionality to it. And I suspect we'll start talking a bit more about what direction does it go, at the same time being very careful to try to avoid imposing a law upon ourselves once again. And then we'll work back from that, I suppose, in terms of how are people motivated, and if ultimately everybody is motivated by God, but the natural man, it is a perverted motivation. I suppose we can talk from the healthy motivation to the perverted motivation, and how does the motivation change. And it may be out of motivational ethics, which, you know, of all things has gotten the least of a swing, which is what Luther and Melanchthon were doing. It may be that that's the kind of direction we'll go, which means that there are a lot of psychologists that will be involved in the business. And it's, you don't have any, well, the closest you get to it is Hume, of course, and Hume is a rather naive sort of position. Although it's very satisfactory, answers a lot of questions, you know, if you immediately know things are wrong, you know, and you don't have to debate about it. You just say, that was wrong, I saw you doing it, and I have no axe to grind. It's an easy way to solve problems.
Do you read Reader's Digest, Bill?
Very, very seldom, Will.
They just had a thing on natural law a couple of issues back.
Yeah.
I don't read it either, but I happen to see it on the grocery counter.
I subscribe to it because I send in all those little numbers where I'm going to get $1,000.
Have you? Oh, I, in the
I subscribe, I, you know, they might look kindly on me.
Well, you're better. Jim, you're more likely to become wealthy sending them in some of your jokes to get printed. They pay anywhere from $25 to $100 per joke, depending on how good it is.
Well, I'm a true believer. I don't think that Henry DeWitt Wallace, you know, just be sending me those things that I shouldn't show
them. Yeah.
Those numbers.
Yeah. It's a kind of a closing thought. I think we ought to note. We talked a little bit about Roman Catholicism. I think that we ought to note that Roman Catholicism and Lutheranism probably are going to need natural law for two different reasons. If Lutherans find a need for natural law, I suppose it will be for reasons of attempting to find a kind of common ground with non-Christians where we can talk about proper behavior. Whereas I think natural law is of crucial importance in traditional Roman Catholicism to support the belief that every man seeks God, and that every man is looking for God, and that at a certain point of advancement, then God comes and meets him. And we don't need natural God. We don't need natural law for that reason in Lutheranism. Now, much of Roman Catholicism, of course, is beginning to move away from that viewpoint. But Roman Catholicism very much needs natural law for the first table of the law. And I think we tend to go in the direction of feeling a need for natural law because of the second table of the law. And so while we converse back and forth with one another, the reasons for having to have it are quite diverse. So, it's been very nice chatting with you this morning. Have a nice cup of coffee. Don't get wet.
Thank you, Bill.
Okay, Paul.